This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices Energy Week, episode number 11, was recorded on July 17th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I'll be joined this week by author and consultant Anas Alhaji, commercial broker Pat Hemsworth, and HedgEye Energy Research Head Joe McMonagle. Our topics this week will include what happened with oil prices, Iran, EIA, or something else, what's going on in Venezuela, and finally, a listener question about crude quality as it affects the Canadian crude market in particular. But first, let's dive into this week's EIA data. Crude oil drawing down 3.1 million barrels, not nearly as big of a drawdown as we saw last week. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.4 million barrels. Meanwhile, gasoline building 3.6 million barrels and distillates building 5.7 million barrels. The tape action was down. Actually, after a delay, it wasn't instantaneously down, but after the market had a little bit of time to digest the data, we ended up closing sharply lower on the day. It's important to remember, however, that this was a hurricane week. The inventory and production data that we received this week was for last week, and last week was a week when the hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico resulted in 12 platforms being evacuated in the Gulf of Mexico, shut-in of production, hurricane affecting refineries on the Gulf Coast, and so on and so forth. So it's definitely an anomaly week in the data, but definitely the tape action had started to the downside with the Iran news, which we're going to talk about at length today, and it just accelerated when we got the EIA report. U.S. production ticking down 300,000 barrels. That sounds like a really big tick down in U.S. production. But again, remember, it's during a week when we had shut-ins in the Gulf of Mexico as a result of the hurricane. Imports and exports both down sharply. Imports down to 6.8 million barrels per day. Exports down to 2.5 million barrels per day. But remember that imports and exports both have everything to do with the ability of ships to transit the Gulf of Mexico. And with a hurricane in the Gulf last week, it's no surprise that everything was down. Now let's meet this week's expert panel. Pat Hemsworth is a commercial broker with Paragon Global Markets, and her decades of experience in both the paper and physical markets give her tremendous insight into the dependencies which exist between markets. Pat, we've had some volatility in refined product markets due to the first hurricane of the season, but more importantly, the permanent closure of the oldest and largest U.S. East Coast refinery, PES. What do you see as the impact of this closure on supply for the Atlantic coast, trade flows, and refining margins?
Yeah, we have had a fair amount of drama, Eric. Before I get into PES, I just wanted to do a quick snapshot of what happened with this hurricane and the effect on the EIA report today. We had a big rainmaker, and we potentially had 2.6 million barrels of capacity, refining capacity at risk. But in the end, probably 500,000 barrels were affected in two refineries, and only one refinery closed down completely. That was Phillips 66 Alliance Refinery. So the refineries, by and large, did not get severely impacted. There was no damage. The damage was really, or the interruption, I should say, was in the Gulf. And the oil platforms were evacuated, and 73% of all our offshore oil production. And we saw today, kind of counterintuitively, we saw big builds in products. But really what that was all about, or to a large extent, it was about reduction of exports. And, South America and Mexico are pretty dependent on the United States, particularly the Gulf, for products. And so I think that could explain the EIA. But, in a more larger and structural sense, PES is a very, very important development for the Atlantic Basin trade in both products and crude. So PES, just briefly, was formed. You know, it's two refineries, total 335,000 barrels a day. It was formed in 2012, purchased from Sunoco and with Carlyle as a private equity lender and Philadelphia Energy Solutions. And for a while, it had a very nice run. Why? Because of the cheap crude from Bakken. And they had an arrangement with Carlyle, a kind of take or pay arrangement for shipping from the Bakken. And that worked out very, very well for a while until it didn't, until the differential between Brent and, you know, U.S. crudes began to narrow. And they still had to pay for the access to the those rail yards. But the financial history is complex, very messy. They went into bankruptcy last year. They came out of bankruptcy, but they faced 2019 with very little cash. And so on June 21st, when PES went up in flames and then experienced a number of explosions in their alkalytic unit, the question immediately that came to everyone's mind was, what's going to happen now? Well, shortly after that, they decided themselves what would happen then. And it would be that they were going to close the refinery and lay off all the workers. And because of union reasons, it was delayed somewhat till August 25th. But and then they tried to sell all of their crude, North Sea crudes, Nigerian crudes, and realized that they were getting absolutely slammed in the cash markets, taking like $5 haircuts. And so it didn't make sense. They have one of their refineries up now, Point Breeze, and that's refining the last of their crude inventories. But so what does this mean for the Atlantic Basin trade? Well, it's a big complex, 335,000 barrels. It's the oldest on the East Coast, 1866 it was built. You know, it's almost like hardwired into the Northeast, New Jersey, South Philly, Western Pennsylvania, well, into West, the West of Pennsylvania. So now we have a complete rupture of that supply chain. So a couple of things I expect to see as a result. One, volatility in product markets going forward. For the rest of the summer, I think we're going to have some issues with RBOB in PADD 1. Number two, I think we're seeing this now. We're seeing weakness in Bakken prices, because there's a reduction of demand from the Bakken region from PES, who was a big occasional but large buyer. Third, Nigeria also was a big supplier to PES, and we saw a kind of a hit for Nigerian grades after this happened. So there's been some disruption in that part of the supply chain. Also, PES provided at least 150,000 barrels a day of gasoline. Sunoco took about 100,000 or more of that. And so that entire supply chain is broken. And we're depending now largely on imports. Why imports, you ask, when PADD 3 is a huge provider, you know, is a huge producer of gasoline and has pretty good stocks? Well, the Colonial Pipeline is the only way up north to the New York Harbor PADD 1 area. And the Colonial Pipeline is allocated. For a while, it was actually frozen. It's allocated now. And we also have the Jones Act, which adds about $5. If we were looking at crude, it would add between $4.50 and $5 on top of what it would cost, say, Irving in northeastern Canada to ship to PADD 1. So we have some structural logistical issues as well. We also have an octane problem because, you know, with the lighter crude slate, we are seeing less octane produced. And this is also coinciding with the implementation of Tier 3 gasoline fuel standards, which are calling for higher octane fuels. So this is a kind of another area of disruption. One other thing that PES was important for was the fact that they were good exporters of diesel to Europe. They made special diesel specifications for Europe. And so there's that disruption. So what will happen now? You know, right now we're getting gasoline from everywhere. India, there's a couple of cargoes from India, believe it or not, of alkylates. You know, we're getting it from the EU, we're getting it from Russia, really from many different locations to try to make up for this key interruption in supply. But, longer term, we look to some other solutions. I think the PADD 1 refiners get another lease on life. They have a lot of structural issues in PADD 1. But also we're looking to the reopening of the old Hovensa refinery in St. Croix, now owned by Lime Bay. So it's really a major disruption in many, many supply chains. And so we're monitoring this very closely, but, there's no rest for the weary in the product trade as a result.
Thanks for that, Pat. Dr. Anas Alhaji is an author, keynote speaker, and energy markets expert. He was formerly the chief economist for NGP Energy Capital Management, and he also taught energy economics at the University of Oklahoma and Colorado School of Mines. Anas, the IEA and other prominent organizations have issued bearish forecasts for 2020. Do you agree with their bearish outlook?
Eric, I do not agree with that. As you mentioned, it's not only the IEA, it is OPEC and other consulting houses. The OPEC bearish outlook is understandable because it does not want to take any chances given the fact that they've been burned several times in recent years. They can increase production anytime they want to or if needed, but to agree again on another cut or extend the cut is always a problem. It seems that with the consulting houses agreeing with them, it seems that conformity is the name of the game today. But the fact is, both the IEA and OPEC are political organizations, and their views reflect their politics. All signs show that shale is not going to deliver in 2020, and production probably has already peaked for this cycle. Most IEA funding comes from the Trump administration, and I can see why the IEA does not want to take a hard look at shale at a time when the Trump administration is withdrawing from international organizations and withholding funding. The IEA flip-flop on oil market in recent months from bullish, tight, OPEC needs to increase production, to bearish. They've done this back and forth several times in recent months. In fact, they already declared mission accomplished on behalf of OPEC while the market was still bearish. The other issue is Brazil is not going to deliver. They have been wrong on Brazil oil production for the last 4 years, and they still overestimate Brazil production. So between the U.S. and Brazil, we are not going to see the supply they are talking about. I'm not going to focus on demand just for the sake of time. But even if we take their low demand figures, if shale and Brazil are not going to deliver, where the oil is going to come from? The fact is shale is suffering. Stocks of shale companies are hammered despite the increase in oil prices simply because of something the IEA cannot understand. Crude quality matters. For those who wants to know more of this, of course, they can check the hashtag crude quality matters on Twitter to understand the issues. But the IEA think crude quality is about refining. That is a naive way of looking at it. Crude quality is about light products and demand. Refining capacity is just a small part of it. The reason why stocks of shale companies were hammered because of the lightest products, that gas and NGLs. That's crude quality. To sum up, crude quality is not only about refining and not only about the past. It is about what is happening with the lightest products right now, which is killing shale companies, especially in the Permian. And just look at their stocks in the recent days. And of course, and what is going to happen in the future for the demand for light products. Final point before I conclude. One of the problems we are having now is circular information. Everyone, including the IEA and OPEC and others, are getting their information about shale from the EIA, that the US EIA. If the EIA is wrong, then everyone else is wrong. And that's the problem why we need the IEA and others basically to take another look at shale so we can have another look that is different from the EIA. To conclude, And this is my last statement, Eric, on this segment. Unlike the IEA, OPEC, and other consulting houses, I remain bullish on 2020. Crude quality has already hit shale companies, and it is going to get worse once Libya, Algeria, and Nigeria increase outputs.
Thanks, Anas. And Joe McMonagle is a former chief of staff of the U.S. Department of Energy and former vice chairman of the IEA. Joe regularly attends OPEC meetings and is a frequent commentator on oil markets for many major media outlets. Joe, you actually attended the meeting in which OPEC extended its production cuts for another 6 months. What do you see as the big takeaways from that meeting, both official policy and what you might have heard behind the scenes, with respect to the cuts rolling over? And I guess maybe another way is, what's really going on here? What's the inside scoop?
Thanks, Eric. Yes, my biggest takeaway from the OPEC meeting in early July was really a new metric and a new target for a drawdown in global crude stocks, a concept that was introduced by Saudi Arabia. Minister Al-Fala said the new goal would be to break into the average of the 2010 to 2014 range and ditching the earlier metric of the five-year average. So while it wasn't officially adopted by OPEC, the Saudis are using it. And so it becomes, I think, the de facto new target. And it would require an additional draw of about 200 to 250 million barrels from global stocks. You know, it's designed to establish, I think, an even tighter physical market than the previous metric of the five-year average range, with the end goal of achieving, at least in the Saudi view, a more stable and higher price range. You know, I think it also hopes to demonstrate that the producer group is serious about the challenge of meeting balanced oil markets. And while the Saudis, I think, are indeed determined, I don't think anyone should think this will be easy. And that's really because of what we just sort of talked about with Anas, essentially, regarding U.S. shale. Because during that 2010 to 2014 range, that occurred during the period without surging U.S. shale. So now, of course, we have it. Now there's the question that Anas just raised about, you know, is it slowing and what will happen moving forward? But that previous period of 2010 to 2014 occurred without surging U.S. shale. And of course, in the last 2 years, shale has added about 3 million barrels a day to oil markets, and at least as forecasted by the EIA and others, to grow by another 500,000 barrels by the end of 2019. So in my view, this was the big news, the metric change, and sort of the new objective to further drain global stocks. You know, the rollover of the cuts, you know, was kind of predetermined at the G20 meeting between President Putin and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. But I think the new 2010 to 2014 metric, along with the longer 9-month extension of the cuts to March of 2020, ushers in what I think is a new active management mode of oil markets by the OPEC Plus group. And by preloading the cuts, especially into 2020, instead of just letting it expire at the end of the year, OPEC hopes to avoid, you know, another year-end price decline that typically occurs because of forecasts of weaker demand in the first quarter. So it's a smart move that likely puts a floor on prices, I think, absent a major stumble in the global economy. It's also a low-risk strategy, since OPEC can revisit the policy at its next regular meeting in 6 months' time in December. And just to add more intrigue, there was already talk before the Vienna meeting ended that the next meeting in December may consider extending the cuts for all of 2020. So they may get really far in advance of the market in terms of lowering supply. And that's unusual for OPEC. They generally don't try to get in front of the market. They generally respond to the market. And so this is a new tactic and a new strategy. And it's something I think the market should start to pay more close attention to.
Joe, I want to comment on what you said, just kind of an extension of what you mentioned, that if they go back to the average of the 5 years between 2010 and 2014, and then you add the line fill in the United States, it does not make any difference after that. So whether they go back or not is the same number. It's about 390 million barrels. So if they do it to 2010, 2014, and they add the line fill, we end up with 390. And I think we are going to hit 390, even if they don't adopt that policy.
Okay, thanks, Joe and Anas. We'll dive into our first topic, which is the price reversal, which has occurred this week, and what the drivers are. News from Iran, EIA, or both. That's coming up right after this. And for our first major discussion topic, we're going to talk about what the drivers have been behind the major reversal in prices this week to the downside. We got news that Iran is ready to negotiate with the United States. But is this really a change in status, or is it just posturing? And how much of this reversal has been driven by the Iran situation versus how much has been an anticipation of what turned out to be a much smaller draw on inventories this week than we've seen in previous weeks? Let's start with Pat Hemsworth. Pat, what is the talk? You obviously sit on a commercial trading desk. What is the big driver, and how are people interpreting the situation with Iran?
Okay, first I'm just going to back up a tiny bit and just say, from May 22nd, we dropped $14 in 10 days. Okay, and then we rallied back on a combination of a number of different factors, including the Fed, pretty much opening the path for the dropping of interest rates. We also had the hurricane coming. A number of different factors converged to rally us up over the $60 level, which was really basically the old lows. So I was kind of suspicious of the rally in the first place. I just didn't know if it was sustainable after such a drop and then just such a panicky spike up. So I just have to say that technical comment first. And then after the hurricane, I was surprised that we really didn't pull back very much. And then it was interesting that it was just the Iranian comment, very quickly denied, you know, by an Iranian news agency, you know, which sold the market off $2.50. So I think that was the catalyst. But I also think that we kind of moved up on air and hope and the recovery in the stock market and the enthusiasm for a rate cut. So, you know, I just think that the Iranian news was a kind of catalyst. I don't know if, you know, I'm sure that Anas and Joe have other observations about what is actually happening behind the scenes, but that was the talk. That was really what, and plus the fact that the hurricane, you know, now it's just an operational issue with people kind of coming back to restaffing the platform. So that's my perception.
Okay, thanks for that, Pat. Joe McMonagle, you run the energy desk for HedgeEye. What's the perspective there?
Yeah, so I would agree with Pat. I would just add the backdrop that is the narrative of, you know, we're still in an oversupplied market and demand is softening. And a lot of that is because of the macroeconomic picture related to trade. So I think that's the backdrop. And so the fact that oil, I think, moved up at all to me was kind of significant. But I agree with what Pat just laid out in terms of the scenarios. And I really do think the Iran thing, you know, the market reaction to, you know, the comment at the cabinet meeting yesterday by Trump and Pompeo that, quote, they were making great progress on Iran, sort of hinting that there would be some negotiations on a missile program, which, by the way, is not out of thin air. I mean, we have heard noises like this. You could question how credible they are from Iran, but there have been new noises about negotiations within Iran. And then that's really what, you know, we saw in the charts what happened to oil until Iran said not so fast, as Pat pointed out. But I think, you know, from the administration's standpoint, and just talking to people quickly yesterday and this morning, I think is that U.S. sanctions, you know, the real progress is that U.S. sanctions have been effective and that they are creating this new, you know, sort of chatter about potential negotiations from some Iranian officials. But, you know, as I think we've heard in the commentary since, Iran really predicates any talks on the suspension of U.S. sanctions. And that's something that Trump will never do. Let me underline that again. Trump will never suspend sanctions. in order for there to be talks. The U.S. feels that their leverage is very strong now, and it's only getting stronger. And I think you may even see something in early August that's going to ratchet up the pressure. So the U.S. is not going to lift sanctions or any kind of leverage that it has now. They think that's what's going to bring Iran to the table, not the lifting of their leverage. But I have to say, I think it's significant also in that there does seem to be some suggestions within at least some factions within Iran that it will consider adding another matter to these negotiations on the nuclear deal, when we were told, you know, by the previous administration that, you know, we tried, Iran just would not consider anything else. And so, you know, I don't want to get into a political discussion here because nobody really cares about my political views. But I do think it is significant that I think it shows that U.S. sanctions are really having an impact. And, you know, there were those who doubted that U.S. sanctions alone would even have an impact. And I think we're seeing that that is not the case, that really U.S. sanctions on Iran are really global sanctions.
Thanks for that, Joe. And Dr. Anas Al-Haji, what's your take?
Okay, it's spice time now. I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, and I'm going to provide a counter argument to what Joe has mentioned. Think about it from the Iranian point of view. The moment they started enriching uranium or increasing the level, all of a sudden, the Trump administration wants to talk to them. So who is holding the cards? I just keep enriching and everyone wants to talk to me. So that's one point. The other point is the decline in oil prices because of the news of possible negotiations does not make sense. Here is why. It took the Obama administration and the Five Plus 3 years to reach an agreement. So why people think that prices have to decline today for negotiations that are going to take a long time? The third point is, I strongly believe, I know Joe does not agree with me on this, but I do have enough evidence to believe that the Iranians are smuggling a lot of oil. And I know some people do not like the word smuggling. Let's say they are selling in the gray market, using their expression. They are selling their a lot of oil in the gray market, and they are making money. This is no different from the hardest times they had before. And ironically, all of a sudden, some neighboring countries' production is increasing at the same time. The problem is monitoring those ships. What is reported in the media, especially the media that monitor shipments, they are reporting only electronic signals. But we all know that there are many tankers that turn off their electronic signals. Shipping firms basically focus on those, whether they turn their signals on or off, monitoring companies can focus on both. The problem is Iran has perfected the game over decades, and there are shipments that no one can monitor unless you are on the ground, unless you know people inside to see how those shipments are being made. So there is the pressure that people are viewing that Iran is suffering, their economy is in very bad shape. Yes, it is in bad shape, but not to the extent of the breaking point. The final point I would like to mention here is there is a strong opposition to the regime in Iran, but there is no better excuse for the failure of the regime in Iran than Trump sanctions. They can blame Trump for all the ills of the regime and benefit from that. At the same time, we have to pay attention to one fact here that is very important. If you look at the whole Middle East, there are only two nation states. That's Iran and Turkey. The rest of the area are just states. They are not nation states. Some people might argue, well, Egypt is almost a nation state. What that means is this distinction is very important, because if Iran is a nation state and they are going to be attacked by others, many Persian people will have no choice but to stand up for their country and their government. That means the resistance to the pressure is higher than other states in the Middle East. So this is just a counter argument to what Joe said, being the devil advocates here.
Thanks for that, Anas. And I'll just add my own comment, which is, as I watch all of this, If I think about the style that we've seen to date from President Donald Art of the Deal Trump, it would make perfect sense to me if their intention is to get tough in a negotiation, and they're also very concerned that we have a rapidly rising oil price. It would make perfect sense to start with a head fake of a fairly innocuous statement that was vague and inspecific, saying we're ready to negotiate with Iran, intentionally shocking oil prices lower before the world finds out that what that really meant is we're ready to get tough with Iran. Joe McMonagle, what do you think?
Well, Eric, the Energy All-Stars is starting to turn into a little bit like Energy Crossfire here. But I appreciate Anas's attempt at devil's advocate. And we've talked about this privately, so I'm familiar with his views. I guess a couple points. One is on the whole idea of Trump wanting to negotiate. I mean, I've said this, I think, on Macro Voices. I think the Iranians are making a big mistake by not engaging with him, even with sanctions in place, because I do think a lot of his policy is driven by the fact that he wants to get a better deal. And I think all I have to do is add one more thing, and that likely is enough for him, probably not for others in his administration and not for Israel, of course, and others. But I think for Trump, it rings the bell in a big way. So I think they're making a mistake. And also, the U.S., you know, has, I think, privately been trying to encourage negotiations since last fall. So I don't think this is anything new, and I don't think it's a result of the enrichment. I was going to raise, I forgot to raise this in my initial comments, that, you know, I think what we're seeing from Iran is that the oil market needs to keep watching this, because I think it's only going to get worse, not better. And I think you see it in a couple ways. And I've sort of described this as, you know, if the U.S. has a maximum pressure policy, Iran has a maximum chaos policy. And number one, you know, as Anas pointed out, they're now, you know, announced or actually surpassing enrichment limits set by the JCPOA. That creates problems for the Europeans, not necessarily the U.S., because the Europeans, you know, they have to decide what are they going to do now on sanctions? How long can they continue Iran to enrich uranium and beyond the limits set under the deal that they're still abiding by? You know, second, you had the UK seize this tanker, this Iranian tanker off of Gibraltar, not because of Iran sanctions, but because of EU sanctions on Syria. And that adds another level of complexity to what the EU is trying to do in terms of salvaging the deal. And then lastly, in the last couple of days, we've seen, you know, a tanker sort of drift into Iranian waters mysteriously. There's a big debate on Twitter whether it was UAE-owned tanker or UAE products or crude. That's kind of beside the point in terms, as far as I'm concerned. I think it's more evidence that Iran is causing trouble in the Straits, and I think that that's really their intended objective. And so I think we're going to see more and more of this. I also believe, based on some conversations I've had with folks in the administration, that they're going to be ramping up the pressure soon. So Iran's going to be feeling more and more pressure from the U.S., not less. And the plan is more pressure and leverage brings Iran to the table, not suspending sanctions in order to get them to the table.
Anas, let's go back to you for the last word on this subject briefly before we move on.
I am going to keep adopting that devil's advocate position and just say the following. If I am an Iranian administration and I see those policies change with every new president coming to the office, why I have to deal with Trump and lose more? I can wait until he leaves office and I can do a better deal with the one who is coming next. And they've been experts on waiting for a long time.
Let's move on now to our next discussion topic for this week's episode, which is Venezuela. Very, very important country in terms of, at least by some measures, the most reserves of any nation in the world for oil. But obviously, the production is way, way down as a result of the political turmoil there. So what's next? And will Chevron get its general license extended? Joe McMonagle, you run the show at Hedgeye's Energy Desk. What's your perspective on what's going on with Venezuela?
Yeah, so I think there are two big decision points coming up. One next week, actually, and that's the whole question of whether the general license for Chevron is going to be renewed or extended by the Treasury Department. Chevron is very aggressively trying to get the waiver extended. They're the only U.S. producer currently involved. There are other, you know, service companies working there, but Chevron is the only producer. And, you know, Chevron would like to keep reserving, I think, their sort of place, even though it's a much reduced capacity. The real, I think, sort of debate, if you will, and I think the administration is considering Chevron's request, but I think the administration thinks it needs to increase the pressure on the Maduro regime. And there's also, I think, a misnomer here that the opposition, sort of the Guaido government, if you will, supports a waiver for extending the waiver for Chevron. Under the theory is that we need to keep a modicum of production going, because if Chevron pulls out and that production goes offline, it'll be really hard to restart the industry again. And so there's kind of a belief, at least in Washington, that the Guaido folks and the opposition supports giving Chevron a waiver. I'm told that's not the case, and that they definitely believe and are advocating internally, but I think more privately than publicly, to the administration that they want the license to end. And so I don't know how much that will factor into the administration's view. Obviously, the administration takes very seriously, I think, the request by a U.S. company. On the other hand, you could argue that it's really providing some oxygen for Maduro and the regime. So that's what I know. Also, I think hanging out there, too, are secondary sanctions. And the administration hasn't really gone there yet. That's allowed China and Russia to continue to do business in Venezuela, including some other European companies. I think Repsol is still involved to a certain extent. And so I know that secondary sanctions are now being seriously considered by the administration. And I think they feel like they have a very short window here to act. I don't feel like they think they have a long time horizon here. And so I see these as two big decision points and catalysts. And obviously, I mean, I think there would be a big hit to production in Venezuela if Chevron was not granted the waiver.
And I'll just add another aspect to this discussion, which is Venezuelan oil is so important because in order to refine all of this super light U.S. shale oil, you have to mix it with heavy blend stock in order to get it to an API that's refinable. And Venezuela and Iran have historically been two of the major suppliers of that heavy blend stock. Without the heavy blend stock, it really creates a huge problem for the rest of the industry. Pat Hemsworth, from the Paragon Global Energy Desk, you deal both with the finished product demand in South America as well as the supply and this whole heavy crude issue and how it fits into the blend stock story. What's your take on the situation in Venezuela and where it's headed?
Well, I think that the current policy is really, what could I say, coming to an inflection point. You know, what Trump and his administration have a big challenge ahead of them. This is, you know, as Joe pointed out, Chevron is really a major producer right now in Venezuela and is producing a quarter of Venezuelan production, 200,000 barrels a day. I mean, Venezuela used to be producing, you know, at one time up to 3 million barrels a day, but it's dropped precipitously for many different reasons. But question is, and maybe this is for another forum, but, you know, the effectiveness of this and how effective the existing policies have been in ousting Maduro. You know, he's still pretty comfortably ensconced there with his army surrounding him. And he desperately needs foreign exchange. I mean, this economy is a pure import economy, and they have no other form of foreign exchange. And so they're desperate. And, you know, and this does have a ripple effect on the country as a whole. And I just really can't seem to distance myself from the humanitarian aspect of this policy that they have. Will it be successful in ousting Maduro? I mean, some people are telling me now that there's going to be, you know, there's more talk about an election, Will that happen? I don't know. I mean, there's talks going on now between, you know, between Guaido and Maduro. They were in Norway, now they're in Barbados. So there is something afoot. I just don't know that denying Chevron the license really advances the cause of ousting Maduro more than hurting the general population. I'm just really not sure. It's more of a question. But certainly it's a tough one for Trump right now, because if Chevron is not in Venezuela, Chevron is an American company that's, you know, that's really been in Venezuela for many years and lived through a lot. So, you know, in a sense, their withdrawal from Venezuela would be really leave a vacuum for China and Russia to fill. And do we want that is the foreign policy question. And, you know, to what extent is it effective, our pulling out and denying Maduro that extra foreign exchange from Chevron? I'm not really sure. Those are questions. I don't have answers to them, but those are important questions, I think.
And Dr. Anas Al-Haji, what's your take on Venezuela?
I think Pat's last statement is very important. If we look at other countries and what happened, like South Sudan, which was part of Sudan in the past, when companies were forced out, they handed their assets to other foreign companies. So the idea of Russians and Chinese and probably Malaysians or others coming in and taking over, the evidence, basically historical evidence, point out that this would happen. And therefore, the decline is not going to be the whole one quarter of production. There will be some decline, but not that much. Literally, Trump is handing Venezuela to Russia on a silver platter right now. And there are several issues here to discuss. We don't have time to go over all of them. But the fact is, the opposition itself right now is already tainted because of two reasons. For their failure to do something, their failure to do anything about the humanitarian crisis that Pat mentioned, and their full cooperation with foreign countries, because that's benefiting really Maduro. He's saying, look, those guys are traitors because they are dealing with our enemies. And that's benefiting Maduro in this case. Let me just read the tweet for you that I wrote yesterday that is relevant to the case of Venezuela, relevant to the cases of places like Syria and Yemen and Libya and Iran, Algeria, etc. Here it is. When 2 to 3 generations in a country grow up under dictatorship where fear, deceit, betrayal, corruption, and violence become the norm, it is impossible to change such culture overnight. It is impossible to trust even the opposition. They came from the same fabric. Think about U.S. policy. So for U.S. basically to cooperate with part of that fabric, we already have seen it before. We've seen it in Iraq. We've seen it in other places. We've seen what happened in Syria. We've seen it what happened in Egypt, etc. It's people of the same fabric. And therefore, to think that we are going to improve the situation immediately, that kind of a naive thinking. So to go back to the issue of Chevron, I think other companies will fill in and Maduro will use that as an excuse for his failure to lead.
Thanks for that, Anas. Before we close today's episode, I want to come to a listener request we had that was directed at you, Anas. The comment that we received was, look, Anas and Art Berman have been talking about how important it is that crude quality matters, but they don't seem to be tying it into the situation in Canada. Specifically, Western Canada Select Crude is trading at a huge discount to WTI, causing a lot of people to wonder, okay, what's going on here? How come that can't be just shipped down and, you know, pumped into the system and that price differential arbitraged out of the market? Anas, what's going on here? Do you have anything to add to your comments in previous episodes about crude quality matters as it pertains specifically to Canada?
Yes. In fact, we covered this in details on Twitter discussions in the past. But the main issue, basically, is pipelines. And pipelines becoming more political than any other energy issue we ever known. And beside the pipelines issues with the United States, we have pipeline issues within Canada itself. So we have domestic Canadian politics, We have U.S. domestic politics, and then we have the international politics between the U.S. and Canada, kind of like they overlay above each other. And that's really the source of the problem. It's all about those pipelines. If we can sort this out and we can solve the issues of pipelines in both countries, then Canadian crude is going to flow freely to the United States. That difference or the price differential is going to disappear and Canadian companies will benefit. And in fact, there is a possibility that if this happens, then this will kill, economically, will kill the Trans Mountain pipeline that Canada is preparing basically to build. But as long as those pipeline issues are not solved within Canada, within the United States, and between the United States and Canada, then the case for the Trans Mountain pipeline is a very strong case. And once, and mark my word for this, the same way the Russians, because of the sanctions, moved to Asia, and they had the taste of Asian markets, and they decided to move forward with Asian markets, we are going to see the same in Canada. Once the Canadians taste the Asian markets, they will focus all their efforts on Asia, and they will starve U.S. market.
Thanks, Anas. Listeners, we need your help putting the word out that there's a new podcast in town, and we intend to become the definitive weekly information source for energy traders, investors, and others interested in energy markets. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes or at macrovoices.com, and you'll also gain access to our Thursday night podcast, which has a much more general macroeconomics focus. And we really need some help from our institutional listeners. Those of you who are working in companies that would be good sponsors for Macro Voices, we really need your help reaching out to your marketing departments and letting them know that this is an opportunity to sponsor content that would give them exposure to people like you, serious professionals and investors that are seriously active in energy markets. I've prepared a detailed video explaining the opportunity for sponsoring Energy Week and other Macro Voices content. You can find that at macrovoices.com/sponsor info. If your company is interested in sponsoring Macro Voices Energy Week, please email me at info@macrovoices.com. Before we close, I want to ask our panelists what they're going to be watching for in energy markets in the coming week. Pat Hemsworth, what are you and the team at Paragon Global Markets going to be watching for in the week ahead?
Well, you know, as I was discussing before, we just came out of this large storm in the Gulf area. And so, you know, what we're looking for is a kind of resumption of normalcy and people coming back to platforms producing crude. Right now, I think we're at about 59% of the platforms are still out. You know, there's a lot of safety precautions that have to be met before they start restaffing. So I'm looking for that, and I'm expecting that we'll continue to see draws in crude based on that interruption of supply. So that's one thing I'm going to be watching for, resumption of exports out of the Gulf of products. And then also I'm expecting a lot of imports coming into PADD 1. So we were supposed to see them this week, but we're getting gasoline from everywhere, you know, from India. We're getting it from Russia. We're getting it from Africa. We're getting it from the EU. So next week, I think we're going to see pretty big gasoline imports. So that's what I'll be watching.
Thanks so much, Pat. Joe McMonagle, you run the show for HedgEye Risk Management, at least with respect to energy markets. What is your team looking at there?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to obviously be watching the inventory data next week to see if we're now on a trend of crude stock draws, although Pat points out that this sort of major rain event caused a bit of a wrinkle in the data, at least I think on the product side. The other thing that I'm going to be watching from a policy perspective is what we just talked about in this, whether the Chevron waiver gets this license for them to keep working in Venezuela gets extended, because I think if it is not extended, I think that's a very good sign that secondary sanctions are coming next, for the very point that Anas and Pat said, that, you know, it creates an opening for Chinese and Russian companies. So I think that would sort of force the U.S. position on secondary sanctions. And so I think that's why it'll be a key driver on the energy policy agenda for next week.
And Dr. Anas Alhaji, what's on your radar screen?
Well, as you all know, Pat explained the increase in product inventories at the start of the program. Here is the problem with crude. EIA overestimated the decline in production and underestimated imports, which led to a major change in adjustment from minus 472,000 barrels a day to plus 524,000 barrels a day. The change is almost 1 million barrels in adjustment. So if you look at next week inventories and look at adjustment plus the impact of the hurricane or the storm, we are going to end up with a very large draw. I was looking for a record draw, but it seemed like it's not going to happen. But I'll be watching inventories. I'll be watching how some OPEC countries are reacting to the recent decline in prices and whether they are reducing exports quietly without talking to anyone. And the third point, which is kind of, I think, important for every trader who is trading equities in the market, I'll be watching Permian companies and Permian names. It seems that there is a possibility that their problems and their trouble is bigger than what people are expecting. And by next week, we'll know more. We are coming to the reporting season, so we'll see how they are performing.
Thanks for that, Anas. Macro Voices Energy Week is released every Wednesday evening. Next week's panel includes Art Berman, Pat Hemsworth, and Chris Cook. But before we let this week's panel go, I'd like to ask each of you to please tell our listeners where they can follow your work and learn more about what you do. Let's start with Pat Hemsworth. Please give our listeners your Twitter handle and contact details.
My Twitter handle is at phemsworth, and I'm very active there, posting on different things that are going on in the market. And I also can be reached by email at phemsworth@paragonglobalmarkets.com. And I produce a daily commentary on the markets, which sometimes can be micro as opposed to macro. But I go into a lot of the price relationships and the activity during the day. So if anyone would like to have that, they could always contact me and tell me their interest in energy, and I will send it to them.
Joe McMonagle from HedgeEye, please tell our listeners how they can follow your work.
Yeah, so you can catch me on Twitter at Joe McMonagle, and also at the HedgeEye.com website, where we frequently post excerpts from my client notes and other research from behind the paywall to give folks a sample of what we do. So at Joe McMonagle on Twitter or HedgeEye.com.
Fantastic. Thanks, Joe. And Dr. Anas Alhaji.
On Twitter, it's my first name, my last name, at Anas Alhaji, A-N-A-S. A-L-H-A-J-J-I, where I am very active there. And then my website, which is the same thing, anasalhaji.com, and people can reach me by emailing me through the website.
Fantastic. Thanks, everybody. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend. We'll see you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.